I hope really this is the continuation of a conversation that we need to have about climate change and what it means for Montana. And I thought before I'd start talking about what's going on in Montana, I wanted to bring up three different topics as kind of background. First of all, you know, who am I and why am I talking about this? Well, you got a little bit of introduction, but I study paleoclimate. I'm a paleoclimatologist. I've been at Montana State University since 2004, and I've looked at paleoclimate around the world, focusing on different timescales and what's happening in different locations. When you study paleoclimate, you're really drawing on a lot of different kinds of climate sensors, I guess. You're looking at things like fossil pollen grains, which we look at, or tree ring records, or bones, or the rings of stalagmites in caves. All of these things tell us something about past climate. And in Montana, most of our information on past climate comes from two sources, either tree ring records. You know, trees grow at different rates depending on the climate, so their records tell us about past climate. Or we look at lake sediments. We go to lakes and get the sediment cores. These cores go all the way to the beginning of the lake, which is usually about 15,000 years here. And we look at the fossils and the components of the sediment to reconstruct climate. So my group spends a lot of time in the lab just sort of painstakingly going through these tree ring cores or these lake sediments to give you a record of what's happened in Montana in the past. The other thing I wanted to bring up is that we all know we've experienced a lot of extreme events in the last year, all around the country and, in fact, all around the world. And what's interesting about these events is their intensity is really surprising. But I think, as you all know, these are weather events, and that's different than climate. Weather is the state of the atmosphere as it's played out over minutes to months. And climate is the average of those weather conditions. And that's the thing we need to keep our eyes on, is what's happening with the climate rather than the weather. And this Norwegian cartoon, I think, really
A common mistake
it well.
When interpreting statistics is to look at them from too short a distance. This can make everything unclear and confusing. So forget the details and take a step back. You're looking at a dog when you should be concentrating on the owner. As you can see, the dog is all over the place, leaping and bouncing, sometimes upwards, sometimes downwards. But where do you think it'll be in 10 seconds' time? Around here, right? But at this moment, the dog is on its way downwards, so why do you think it'll find itself up there? It's because you've noticed the owner. The owner is the trend, and it's he who determines where they both will be in a while as a bit longer than a couple of dog bounds. He could change direction. There's a lot we don't know about this guy. But everything we do know indicates he's heading in that direction. The owner is the long-term trend. The dog is the variation around this trend. Or, the owner is the climate. The dog is the weather.
Isn't that good? I love that. So even though we're having, you know, record frosts in Georgia tonight, I think it's important to realize that the thing we really need to focus on is the trend, the guy, the climate. And this is what we've seen. So this is some of the things that have happened recently. So the last 100 years or so are the warmest of the last 1,700 years, and we've seen almost a 2-degree Fahrenheit increase in the U.S. The last 5 years have been the warmest on record, both in the U.S. and globally. And in 2017, we've had 17 weather climate disasters that have exceeded $1 billion in property damage. And this is everything from hurricanes, floods, droughts, tornadoes, you name it. Now, this is just coming out from the National Climate Assessment, and you can see this trend, what this owner is doing. It's been steadily getting warmer. And here's a picture of that warming, how much temperature change there's been over that time period. And there's huge warming primarily in the Arctic, but also you can see in the western U.S. as well and all around the world. So that's what we want to focus on. And the other topic I wanted to bring up that you sometimes hear is, you know, how precedented is what we're seeing now. is this sort of business as usual? We all know the climate's changed in the past. Are we really seeing something different? And this is where I come in as a paleoclimatologist. Well, first of all, the best climate records that go back a million years, about 800,000 years, are the ice core records. Now, I don't study these personally, but people at MSU do. And what you see is up and down in climate over the last 800,000 years. These are what we call glacial, when it's cold, going down, and cold, and interglacial, when the temperature's warm. So the climate's gone from warm to cold, warm to cold, back and forth. And this bundle of cold to warm, a single cycle, lasts about 100,000 years. And you notice that with each warming, carbon dioxide goes up, and with each cooling, carbon dioxide goes down. And there's sort of a natural range of temperature that characterizes glacial and interglacial cycles, and characteristic ranges of carbon dioxide, as shown here. And the point is this is where we are now. And actually, we're even higher. The CO2 in the atmosphere now is about 410 parts per million. And this didn't take place over the entire interglacial that we live in now, which we call the Holocene. It's happened in the last couple of centuries. So this is the last 11,000 years of climate history. And we do see that there have been warm periods in the past. We have this period from about 10,000 to 7,000 years when it was warm, and we call that the early Holocene thermal maximum. And then in the last 7,000, 6,000 years, the climate's gotten steadily cooler. We had a little blip of warming here. This is the medieval climate anomaly, or the medieval warm period about 1,000 years ago. We had a drop here. This is the Little Ice Age. But this is what we're talking about now. This is the thing that's really causing us all a lot of concern, and it's happened, as I said, in the last couple centuries. Now, how far back in time would you have to go to get over 400 parts per million? Well, here's the last up and downs that I showed you from the ice core record. These are the glacial interglacial cycles. And this goes back to the Pliocene 5 million years ago. The last time we saw high levels of CO2 getting up to about 410 parts per million is about 3 million years ago. At that time, it was about 6, 7.5 degrees warmer. Globally, it was really warm in the poles. There was no Greenland ice sheet. There was no West Antarctic ice sheet. And so the average estimates for sea level then are about 25 meters higher than today. In Montana, based on what we look at from the fossil record in Montana, probably would have looked like, I don't know, Western South Carolina. It was very humid. There were a lot of deciduous trees. It really was a very, very different place. So I don't know if that makes you feel good that we could go to the Pleistocene, we could live in a world like the Pleistocene, but you know that's about the equivalent of what we're seeing today. The deal is that our present climate hasn't equilibrated with those levels of CO2. The climate science special report that came out at the end of 2017 really pulls no punches. It says it is extremely likely that human influence has been the dominant cause of the observed warming since the mid-20th century. That's it. That's what the evidence shows. And it also says for warming over the last century, there is no convincing alternative explanation supported by the extent of observational evidence than it's related to the anthropogenic input of greenhouse gases. In other words, the scientific community's looked at volcanic forcing, they've looked at solar variability, they've looked at ocean atmosphere interactions, and they cannot explain the trend that we are seeing now. And the evidence for that are all these things that are discussed in the report. So I highly recommend that you go to that site and look at it. It's really pretty compelling. Okay, so that's my background. So let's talk about the Montana Climate Assessment. And I thought first I'd tell you a little bit about how it came to pass that we did this assessment. It was a 3-year process, and it involved a lot of partners. It wasn't just the universities, but it was university scientists from both Montana State University and the University of Montana. It's one of the few times maybe when the universities have really worked closely together on something, but it was very, very rewarding. And it also involved federal and state agencies working with us and several non-governmental organizations as well. So it was a great collaboration and collective effort to try to get this information with the goal of trying to understand what's happening in Montana, given what we know that's happening globally and in the U.S. Another motivation was that we got a large grant about 5 years ago from the National Science Foundation. This is what we call our EPSCoR grant, and it was about $20 million, which allowed us to hire a lot of fabulous faculty with interests in ecosystem science and also to take on some really fundamental research about Montana. The question of that grant was, what is Montana's ecological vulnerability to climate change? And so we broke up the researchers into groups. One of them was looking at microbial dynamics and how that affects process. Another group was looking at process and how it affects the kinds of landscape patterns and the way landscapes are shaped. And then a third group was really looking at the overall climate and how it gets filtered through all of this to define vulnerability. Now, this graph sort of took manifestations over the last 5 years, and the different focus groups worked together and tried to integrate what they were doing, and there was a social ecological systems initiative that was added on. But our ultimate goal, besides publishing scientific papers, was to get something to the stakeholders of Montana. And we promised to the National Science Foundation that we would do a report of some sort on Montana's vulnerability to climate change. And so that has led to this Montana climate assessment. Another motivation for the climate assessment was that our Constitution itself sort of demands that we do this kind of analysis. The Constitution guarantees Montanans to a clean and healthful environment. It was ratified in, I think, 1972. And there's a law associated with the Constitution that requires regular reporting on the state of the environment. Well, there'd been two reports, really, since the ratification of the Constitution. There was a report that came out in 1975 called Montana's Environmental Indicators, and then a report in 1996, Our Montana Environment. And that's been really it, except recently the DNRC produced the Montana State Water Plan, which was really an effort to bring a lot of information together. So we felt that there was a lot of opportunity for us, a gap to fill, by trying to talk about the science of climate change and what it means for the state. Now, in some ways, our report is a little bit of an experiment because we've done it in a way that's different than other states. We started by talking to stakeholders, and we spent about a year going around to different groups and organizations and individuals. We sent out surveys, and in the end, we figured we talked to about 900 citizens in Montana. And we asked them some basic questions. We said, what kinds of decisions do you make that you feel are impacted by climate? What types of information do you need that you don't have your hands on in making those decisions? And then how would you like the information? How is the best way to get information to you? And it was their responses then that informed the development of this assessment. So we also wanted to not do something that would be, not judged as a credible document nationally. So we've been working closely with the U.S. Global Change Program and their efforts. And as I said, we wanted to build on university science and the engagement and partners that we had in the Institute. And we knew that we didn't have enough time to address every topic, so we wanted to address three topics in particular. And those were the ones that our stakeholders felt were their highest demands. And that was for information on water, forests, and agriculture. So those are the current Montana climate assessment focuses that. But we want to have these be useful and updatable and a sustained enterprise, so we're looking forward to doing other topics as they come up. Okay, so how is Montana's climate changing? Well, how many of you have lived in the state for more than 20 years? All right, 30 years? Have you noticed that Montana's climate is changing? What's happening? It definitely is getting warmer. It's actually gotten about 3 degrees warmer since 1950. Here's the mean annual temperature of Montana. You can see it's highly variable across the state. But there's this very robust increase in temperatures since 1950, and it's really part of a trend that's gone on since about 1895. Now, precipitation actually shows no trend since 1950. It's been highly variable, and it's been very... there's been a lot of interannual variability related to things like whether we're in a La Nina or an El Nino year. There's been an increase a little bit in eastern Montana in the spring, and there's been a decrease in western Montana in the winter, but generally not a clear pattern. Okay, to look into the future, what we did is we, well, first of all, future projections are based on these very complicated climate models. And there's a whole array of climate models to choose from. And we picked the 20 that seemed to do the best job of reconstructing Montana's historic climate and also doing a good job of looking at the historical trends in the U.S. So we picked 20 of these, what they call general circulation models. And we downscaled them to a very fine level, and then we upscaled them to the level of climate regions. So these are NOAA climate regions, these 7 regions. This work was done by the Montana Climate Office at the University of Montana. And we looked at 2 scenarios for the future. One's called RCP 4.5, and the other is RCP 8.5. This one is the stabilization scenario. So this is if we not only reach the goals of the Paris Accord, but we actually exceed them a little bit in reducing the input of greenhouse gases. This one, RCP 8.5, is what they call business as usual. In other words, this is the trajectory we're on. Carbon dioxide, greenhouse gases are increasing, and this is, you know, where we are unless we make some big changes. Okay, so... And I'm going to just show you things for the middle of the century because it's almost too depressing to just jump to the end of the century, and hopefully we'll all be alive in the middle of the century and we can see if these are right. So by 2050, if you take the stabilization scenario, there's about a 4.5 degree increase in temperature in Montana. If you do the business as usual, it's about a 6 degree increase. And it doesn't matter what part of the state you're looking at. That's a widespread signal. We then broke it down into these different regions, these climate regions, and also by month, because I think we focus a lot on the weather, the monthly weather. And what we found is there was greater warming in the winter, but also a lot of warming in the summer. So warming happens in all the seasons, but a lot of us are used to warmer summers, but we have to keep in mind that winters are getting warmer as well. And I should say, all of these models agreed, so that's what gives us 100%, you know, we see 100% model agreement, so we're pretty confident in those results. Precipitation is, again, spatially variable, just like present day. What you see is that it gets wetter in some parts of the state, and in this scenario, it gets wetter as well. So it's anywhere from 1.3 to 1.6 inches. There's fairly high model agreement in that. And you can look at the trends for that. There's increases in precipitation in the winter, spring, and fall in both of these scenarios, and generally decreases in the summer. So Bozeman area is in the southwest area. This is it for the months. Models, again, don't have as good agreement as temperature. Now, it's important to know that just because precipitation increases, it doesn't mean it's going to get wetter, right? Because if you have this huge increase in temperature, you're basically increasing evaporation, and there comes a point when no matter the fact that you're getting it wetter doesn't mean it's going to be... The fact that it's more rainfall or snowfall doesn't mean it's going to show up as being a wetter climate. Okay, so here's the summary of the climate stuff. The average temperatures have risen 2 to 3 degrees since 1950, and winter and springs have warmed the most. Our growing season is 12 days longer now than it was in 1950. That might be a good thing. And there's no real patterns in annual or seasonal precipitation. The big message for Montana is warming, 4 to 6 degrees by 2050 and almost 10 degrees by the end of the century. That's a really different world. And precipitation is increasing slightly in winter, spring, and fall, and decreasing in summer. Okay, well, what does that mean for water? Let me start by showing you a little video. We hired a MSU film student to travel with us as we were talking to people and to record what some of their concerns were about climate change in Montana, and I really like this particular podcast.
Water is the most fundamental resource in the West. So obviously, managing the water we have in the best available way requires cooperation up and down the river.
My name is Diane Algren. So my family originally started here. Grandpa Dave came probably about 1910.
I'm Robert Goffney, and I guess I'm a retired rancher. And our family has been here since the late 1800s. Well, we've had a lot of challenges because as water was increasingly used for irrigation, people were expanding beyond the ability of the river to sustain it. And so our trouble on the Mussel Shell was how to share water fairly.
So my name is Bill Melton, and I've been working for over 20 years on water-related issues as a facilitator around conflicts.
Bill and a couple of different ones came and talked about doing a whole river watershed group and get everybody in the same room and try to talk about things rather than just sit at home and be mad about it.
So let's go to Dead Man's, because we got plenty of Dead Man's representation here. How's that gone?
We're at 38,000 acre feet today. Which
and the communication of all the water managers and some of the landowners through the coalition has been very beneficial.
So we haven't been as low as we're probably going to be at the end of the season in about, except for one time in 10 years.
And so the idea was, how can we step back, work together, and figure out how would we approach this as a basin and really get people to identify what their real needs are.
And now they're using the government grants to fix our systems and improve the percentage of water that we are able to use.
And as we were just starting to warm up to that practice, 2011 came and we experienced the most historic flood that the basin had ever experienced.
Well, I think in 2011 it was kind of a perfect storm. We had a large snowpack that year and we were seeing a lot of runoff happening early in the spring. The next couple of days we had quite a bit of rain.
1,000 CFS isn't unrealistic flows for heavy spring runoff, but we started seeing it climb.
My project manager, Terry Heiss, called up and said, "This is the biggest water I've ever seen." And so I rushed to get my grandkids from school. It was the last day of school. And I seen that the Busy Bee was already underwater, probably 5 foot. We loaded up and I run for home. And then we got here and then we were on an island.
And Mussel Shell had a number of floods over the years. This was kind of the mother load of floods, tearing fields up and the whole works. But what was unique, the fact that we had that group together, there was this place that could receive information. And we're able to get a grant where we had some resource professionals come visit with landowners and begin to say, how would we start rebuilding infrastructure based on the hydrology of the river?
They say that this was like a 127-year event, but we have had a few 100-year events localized on the Musselshell in the 25 years that I've been here.
For climate change, there's some good things that happen and some bad things, but it seems like the floods are getting a little bigger in intensity and a lot nearer together.
It's really interesting how the world looks at climate change as a debate's role. There seems to be a lot of people trying to prepare. So
I feel that having climate information is definitely a plus, because if there's an issue, the first thing you have to do is identify the problem, and you have to identify the facts, and from that point on you can make decisions.
And I don't know that anybody's got it all figured out, but if we keep communicating and talking to the other side, because I have my agenda where I'm coming from, and I know they do too, but if we can communicate a little bit and compromise a little bit, I think it can be done.
And this is really what the whole world needs. It's just humans have the capacity to solve a lot of problems if they're not tied up in conflict all the time. And we actually have a plan here that for most floods will move the water through and not over people.
And we just, as a group, we just got so much done and made this river so much better down here at the bottom. And there's really no better feeling than that.
I really find that film inspirational. Those people in the Musselshell really are doing such a great job. But let me move on to water, a little bit more detail. We focused in on seven watersheds in Montana. This was work led by the Montana Water Center, and then looked at how hydrology was being affected by the climate changes that we were projecting. So let me start with climate and snowpack. When you go back in time, you can see how present-day snowpack trends compare to the last, say, 900 years. So this is based on tree ring reconstructions of how much snow there is April 1st, the snow water equivalent, I should say. And you can see that it's fluctuated a lot. It was high at some points. And then here's what's happened since the 1900s, and here's what's happened in 2000s. So we've been on this declining trend of snowpack that definitely looks different than what we've seen before. And when we look at shorter-term records, so this is 1955 to 2016. Now the red dots, so this is western U.S., the red dots are showing are snowpack measurements that are showing declines, and blue is the snowpack sites that are showing an increase in snowpack, again, from 1955 to 2016. And you can see that Montana is in the majority here and showing that there's been a tremendous decline in snowpack since 1955, anywhere from 80% up to 80% change in some stations, with very few anomalies showing more snow. And you can see that for individual sites. So this is snowpack west of the divide, and you can see that with a five-year moving average through it, and you can see that there's been a 20% decline at this particular site. There's a lot of variability, but the long-term trend is towards less snowpack. When we go into the future, you can see the two scenarios going into the future, and what you see is that west of the Continental Divide, like the Clark Fork River around St. Regis, shows lower snowpack going into the future, both in the 4.5 and the 8.5 scenario. When you get to the Missouri River around Tustin, it's still a decline, but less of a decline. And then as you get to the Yellowstone above Billings, it's still a percentage of decline, but not as great. But also notice the high variability around those estimates, that is the vertical lines here. showing you how much variability in those estimates are. Nonetheless, they all show a decline in the future in snowpack. So the trends that we're seeing now are likely to continue. And you can think about how snowpack then affects water supply. So this is the timing of runoff, peak runoff in the West, again for the period going from, this is from 1948 to 2002. So the red dots are when the runoff has become earlier in the years than it used to be, and the blue dots are where it's coming later. And you can see that there's about a two-week increase over this time period. Our peak runoff comes about 2 weeks earlier than it used to. And here's the projected trends, that it's going to come at least another 2 weeks or 3 weeks earlier than what we're seeing now. So enjoy the snow that we have now, and we'll check in with each other in February and March and see what's going on. In the future, what you can see, this is a stream west of the Cascades, west of the Continental Divide. You get this earlier runoff happening. It's happening earlier in the season. And then by the time you go into the spring and summer, you've got a projected decrease in flow. So you get peak runoff earlier, and it's probably a big peak runoff. But then by the time you get into summer, you've got less flow than you've had than you have presently. And this is going into the future 20 in the middle of the century. As you go farther east, because it gets wetter, you don't see quite that same trend. You see a peak runoff, but not so much of a decrease in peak flow. But then again, these are drier streams to begin with. Okay, a lot of people think, well, we've got groundwater. Groundwater will be okay. But actually, groundwater is also very highly influenced by climate. So, for example, this is the Madison Aquifer around Great Falls. Let me show you. And this is data from January 1995 to January 2015. And this is the level of the aquifers or the wells over that time period. So you can see it was high in 95, and then it dropped in 2005, and then it's increased. And that pattern is really independent of the number of wells that have been put in, which is steadily increased. So you can't explain this drop and rise as having anything to do with the number of wells. In fact, it seems to be very closely related to climate, so that when you have wetter years in 1995, you had high wells, then you went through this dry period, the wells dropped, then it's been wetter and the wells have risen. So these wells are very influenced by climate, and in this particular case, it's very influenced by year-to-year variations in climate. So groundwater is not going to be a solution for us. In fact, it'll be as vulnerable as anything else. Now, when you look at groundwater west of the Continental Divide, there's even shorter. There's even a shorter time relationship between climate and how those wells work. They're very strongly related to what's happening in a season and how that affects irrigation, and then how irrigation leaks into the groundwater. And drought is the thing we've all been thinking about this year. Again, when you go back to the tree ring record, you can see that there's been these periods of time in the past when we've had what we call mega droughts. So these are droughts that last for decades, at least a decade, maybe two or three decades. And those are, for example, there was a mega drought in this area in 936, 1034, 1150, and 1253. These really pronounced and protracted periods of drought. And then there's been wet periods as well. We are not experiencing a mega drought right now. We just see seasonal drought. We see drought that comes and goes seasonally, but it's not lasting through the year, year after year, decade after decade. But what we are seeing, and what we do see in the projections, is that if you increase the number of really warm days, like the days that are above 90 degrees, when you do have drought, it's going to be worse than it would be. So rising temperature really exacerbates the effects of drought. And because we're supposed to have as much as 35 additional days of above 90 degrees going into the future, I think drought is really going to be affecting a lot of the state. And, of course, we have this summer to look at as an example of the kinds of situations that we could well see in the future. We had a very anomalous drought. As you know, it was a wet winter and a wet spring last year, and it was warm. The temperatures continued to rise in the summer, and that flipped us from being warm and wet when the precipitation stopped to being warm and dry. So almost instantaneously, we went into a drought. The news media calls it a flash drought. I don't know if I like that term, but it's kind of effective, like a flash flood. We went into a flash drought. And it happened within days. We had over 21 days in July that were record temperatures above 90 degrees in Montana. And of course, we had these large fires. It was the second or third, depending on the data set you use, largest fire year in Montana's history. It cost almost $400 million in federal and state funds to fight the fires. And there was a report from the University of Montana that said that that's about the same amount we lost in tourist dollars because of the fires. So you can't say this event was a result of climate change, but this is absolutely consistent with what we will probably see in the future. And then just one last topic, what does it mean for agriculture? Well, this is work led by Bruce Maxwell and other people at Montana State University. And it's kind of a mixed picture with agriculture. You can imagine that decreasing snowpack is going to reduce the irrigation capacity for a lot of things that need irrigation. So that's going to affect hay, sugar beets, barley, potatoes, and garden production. Just things that require irrigation are going to be really affected. But on the other hand, the longer growing season could let us grow crops that we haven't grown for a while or we haven't tried. You know, they have a pretty good cantaloupe crop now coming out of western Montana that hasn't been grown there before, and that's only because it's been warmer than it used to be. And people are talking about planting corn in more areas of Montana, although there's a lot of vulnerability and risk when you do that kind of crop change, and corn isn't necessarily a solution. There's also a shift from spring wheat now to winter wheat. And the number of days that are 90 degrees are going to impact wheat, and they're going to really stress our livestock, and we saw that last summer. And also winter annual weeds will really benefit from some of these conditions, things like cheatgrass. So there's a lot of things at play to think about. And before I was involved in the climate assessment, I really hadn't realized how complicated the decision-making space of a person in agriculture really is, because what's happening with climate is just one consideration in all the things that they're taking into account when they decide what to do for a particular year. You know, there's government policies and insurance, and the global price makes a difference versus the local price. You know, in some ways, whether we plant lentils in Montana has as much to do with the climate in India and how well lentils are growing in other parts of the world, you know, to decide whether you would plant lentils here. How much production input do you need on your land to make it grow? And then what's going to be the interactions with pests? It's a really complicated topic. And so I think that it's not accurate to just say that farmers are only driven by climate change in their decision making. They actually have a lot of things going on, and they're making very fast decisions based on a lot of input. Okay, so I won't talk about forests because I just don't want to run you through a whole list, but I think you can imagine more fires and more insect outbreaks and that sort of thing. So I just wanted to tell you a little bit about what we're doing now. The assessment was released in September, and it's available on the web. You can download any part of it, or you can use the website. It's quite lovely. But we've been going around the state and doing a roadshow, basically, with the different authors, talking about climate change, talking about the assessment, and getting feedback. We want to know, what topics should we cover next? What topics, how have we done on these topics? What have we missed? How can we improve it? We've met with the congressional leaders. They've all gotten copies of the assessment. Our governor has gotten a copy. We've had roundtable discussions. We've met with teachers. We've just released today a bunch of teaching materials on the Montana climate assessment, so you can go through that. We've gone in the field with people from the tribal communities and talked about the plants that are of concern to them and various topics that they worry about. So we're really trying to bring the science out to the public. And I have to say we've had incredibly positive responses from people across the state. We've only had one real shout out from a guy in Kalispell, but most people are like incredibly grateful. I know Kalispell, what can you say? Most people are really grateful for the information, and it's been gratifying for us and rewarding. And the next thing we're doing now is thinking about what's next for the MCA. So we have this really great partnership in place from the assessment, and we want to build on that and really talk about how we can go from this knowledge to science to knowledge to action type of step. So, you know, it isn't just enough for us to give you information. We really have to talk about what are the things that we should be thinking about, and how should we incorporate climate change in our planning, and how can we make better decisions that will allow us to adapt to climate change, but also reduce the causes, the greenhouse gases that are causing climate change. And so that's where we are now, and it's still in the sort of incubation stage, but we're calling this new entity MAKE, Montana Adaptation Knowledge Exchange, and we hope that under this umbrella of MAKE, we'll be able to do the next climate assessment on other relevant topics that we haven't yet covered. So I think with that, I'll stop and take questions. So thank you.